Random House Audiobooks and Books on Tape present Airframe by Michael Crichton, read for you by Francis Cassidy. Although based on real events, this is a work of fiction. Characters, companies, organizations, and agencies in this novel are either the product of the author's imagination or, if real, used fictitiously without any intent to describe their actual conduct. Descriptions of certain aircraft systems have been altered to protect proprietary information. Descriptions of real aircraft incidents involving Aloha Airlines, American Airlines, Continental Airlines, and U.S. Air have been taken from the findings of the National Transportation Safety Board. The damn things weigh 500,000 pounds, fly a third of the way around the world, and they carry passengers in greater comfort and safety than any vehicle in the history of mankind. Now, are you fellas really going to stand there and tell us you know how to do the job better? Are you going to pretend you know anything about it at all? Because it looks to me like you boys are just stirring folks up for your own reasons. Aviation legend Charlie Norton, 78, speaking to reporters in 1970 after an airplane crash. The irony of the information age is that it has given new respectability to uninformed opinion. Veteran reporter John Lawton, 68, speaking to the American Association of Broadcast Journalists in 1995. Monday. Aboard TPA 545. 5:18 a.m. Emily Jansen sighed in relief. The long flight was nearing an end. Morning sunlight streamed through the windows of the airplane. In her lap, little Sarah squinted in the unaccustomed brightness as she noisily sucked the last of her bottle and pushed it away with tiny fists.
"That was good, wasn't it?" Emily said.
"Okay, up we go." She raised the infant onto her shoulder, began to pat her back. The baby gave a gurgling belch, and her body relaxed. In the next seat, Tim Jansen yawned and rubbed his eyes. He had slept through the night, all the way from Hong Kong. Emily never slept on planes. She was too nervous.
"Morning," Tim said, looking at his watch.
"Just a couple of hours more, hon. Any sign of breakfast?"
"Not yet," Emily said, shaking her head. They had taken Trans-Pacific Airlines, a charter from Hong Kong. The money they saved would be useful when they set up housekeeping at the University of Colorado, where Tim was going to be an assistant professor. The flight had been pleasant enough. They were in the front of the plane, but the stewardesses seemed disorganized, the meals coming at odd times. Emily had turned down dinner because Tim was asleep, and she couldn't eat with Sarah sleeping in her lap. And even now, Emily was surprised by the casual behavior of the crew. They left the cockpit door open during the flight. She knew Asian crews often did that, but it still struck her as inappropriate. Too informal, too relaxed. The pilots strolled around the plane at night, kibitzing with the stewardesses. One was leaving right now, walking to the back of the plane. Of course, they were probably stretching their legs. Stay alert, all of that. And certainly the fact that the crew was Chinese didn't trouble her. After a year in China, she admired the efficiency and attention to detail of the Chinese. But somehow the whole flight just made her nervous. Emily put Sarah back down in her lap. The baby stared at Tim and beamed.
"Hey, I should get this," Tim said. Fumbling in the bag under his seat, he brought out a video camera, trained it on his daughter. He waggled his free hand to get her attention. "Sarah, Sarah, smile for Daddy, smile." Sarah smiled and made a gurgling sound. "How does it feel to be going to America, Sarah? Ready to see where your parents are from?" Sarah gurgled again. She waved her tiny hands in the air.
"She'll probably think everybody in America looks weird," Emily said. Their daughter had been born 7 months ago in Hunan, where Tim had studied Chinese medicine. Emily saw the camera lens pointed at her.
"And what about you, Mom?" Tim said. "Are you glad to be going home?"
"Oh, Tim," she said, "please." She must look like hell, she thought, all those hours.
"Come on, Em, what are you thinking?"
She needed to comb her hair. She needed to pee. She said,
"Well, what I really want, what I have dreamed about for months, is a cheeseburger."
With Yishang hot bean sauce? Tim said. God, no, a cheeseburger, she said, with onions and tomatoes and lettuce and pickles and mayonnaise. Mayonnaise, God, and French's mustard. You want a cheeseburger too, Sarah? Tim said, turning the camera back to their daughter. Sarah was tugging at her toes with one tiny fist. She pulled her foot into her mouth and looked up at Tim. Tastes good, Tim said, laughing. The camera shook as he laughed. Is that breakfast for you, Sarah? Not waiting for the stewardess on this flight? Emily heard a low rumbling sound, almost a vibration that seemed to come from the wing. She snapped her head around. What was that? Take it easy, Em, Tim said, still laughing. Sarah laughed too, giggling delightfully. We're almost home, honey, Tim said. But even as he spoke, the plane seemed to shudder, the nose of the plane turning down. Suddenly everything tilted at a crazy angle. Emily felt Sarah sliding forward off her lap. She clutched at her daughter, pulling her close. Now it felt like the plane was going straight down, and then suddenly it was going up, and her stomach was pressed into the seat. Her daughter was a lead weight against her. Tim said, "What the hell?" Abruptly, she was lifted off the seat, her seat belt cutting into her thighs. She felt light and sick to her stomach. She saw Tim bounce out of his seat, his head slamming into the luggage compartments overhead, the camera flying past her face. From the cockpit, Emily heard buzzing, insistent alarms, and a metallic voice that said, "Stall! Stall!" She glimpsed the blue-suited arms of the pilots moving swiftly over the controls. They were shouting in Chinese. All over the aircraft, people were screaming, hysterical. There was the sound of shattering glass. The plane went into another steep dive. An elderly Chinese woman slid down the aisle on her back, screaming. A teenage boy followed, tumbling head over heels. Emily looked at Tim, but her husband wasn't in his seat anymore. Yellow oxygen masks were dropping, one swinging in front of her face, but she could not reach for it because she was clutching her baby. She was pressed back into her seat as the plane descended steeply, an incredibly loud, whining dive. Shoes and purses ricocheted across the cabin, clanging and banging. Bodies thumped against seats, the floor. Tim was gone. Emily turned, looking for him, and suddenly a heavy bag struck her in the head, a sudden jolt, pain, blackness and stars. She felt dizzy and faint. The alarms continued to sound. The passengers continued to scream. The plane was still in a dive. Emily lowered her head, clutched her infant daughter to her chest, and for the first time in her life, began to pray. SoCal Approach Control, 5:43 a.m. SoCal Approach, this is Trans-Pacific 545. We have an emergency. In the darkened building that housed Southern California Air Traffic Approach Control, Senior Controller Dave Marshall heard the pilot's call and glanced at his radar screen. Trans-Pacific 545 was inbound from Hong Kong to Denver. The flight had been handed over to him from Oakland A-Rink a few minutes earlier, a perfectly normal flight. Marshall touched the microphone at his cheek and said, "Go ahead, 545. Request priority clearance for emergency landing in Los Angeles." The pilot sounded calm. Marshall stared at the shifting green data blocks that identified each aircraft in the air. TPA 545 was approaching the California coastline. Soon it would pass over Marina del Rey. It was still half an hour out of LAX. Marshall said, "Okay, 545, understand you request priority clearance to land. Say the nature of your emergency." "We have a passenger emergency," the pilot said. "We need ambulances on the ground. I would say 30 or 40 ambulances, maybe more." Marshall was stunned. "TPA 545, say again, are you asking for 40 ambulances? "Affirmative. We encountered severe turbulence during flight. We have injuries of passengers and flight crew." Marshall thought, "Why the hell didn't you tell me this before?" He spun in his chair, beckoned to his supervisor, Jane Levine, who picked up the extra headset, punched in, and listened. Marshall said, "Trans-Pacific, I copy your ground request for 40 ambulances." "Jesus," Levine said, making a face. "40? The pilot was still calm as he replied, Roger, approach, 40. Do you need medical personnel, too? What is the nature of the injuries you're bringing in?
I am not sure. Levine made a spinning gesture. Keep the pilot talking.
Marshall said, Can you give us an estimate?
I am sorry, no. An estimate is not possible.
Is anyone unconscious?
No, I do not think so, the pilot answered. But two are dead.
Holy shit, Jane Levine said. Nice of him to tell us. Who is this guy?
Marshall hit a key on his panel, opening a data block in the upper corner of the screen. It listed the manifest for TPA 545.
Captains John Chang, senior pilot for Trans-Pacific.
Let's not have any more surprises, Levine said. Is the aircraft all right? Marshall said.
TPA 545, what is the condition of your aircraft?
We have damage to the passenger cabin, the pilot said. Minor damage only.
What is the condition of the flight deck? Marshall said.
Flight deck is operational. FDAU is nominal. That was the flight data acquisition unit, which tracked faults within the aircraft. If it said the plane was okay, it probably was.
Marshall said, I copy that 545. What is the condition of your flight crew?
Captain and first officer in good condition. 545, you said there were injuries to the crew.
Yes, two stewardesses have been hurt.
Can you specify the nature of the injuries?
I'm sorry, no, one is not conscious. The other one, I don't know.
Marshall was shaking his head. He just told us nobody was unconscious.
I'm not buying any of this, Levine said.
She picked up the red phone. Put a fire crew on level one alert. Get the ambulances. Order neuro and ortho teams to meet the plane and have medical notify the West Side hospitals. She looked at her watch. I'll call the LAFSDO. This'll make his damn day.
LAX, 5:57 a.m. Daniel Green was the duty officer at the FAA Flight Standards District office on Imperial Highway, half a mile from LAX. The local FSDOs, or FISDOs as they were called, supervised the flight operations of commercial carriers, checking everything from aircraft maintenance to pilot training. Green had come in early to clear the paper off his desk. His secretary had quit the week before, and the office manager refused to replace her, citing orders from Washington to absorb attrition. So now Green went to work, muttering. Congress was slashing the FAA budget, telling them to do more with less, pretending the problem was productivity and not workload. But passenger traffic was up 4% a year, and the commercial fleet wasn't getting younger. The combination made for a lot more work on the ground. Of course, the FSDOs weren't the only ones who were strapped. Even the NTSB was broke. The safety board only got $1 million a year for aircraft accidents, and... The red phone on his desk rang, the emergency line. He picked it up. It was a woman at air traffic control.
We've just been informed of an incident on an inbound foreign carrier, she said.
Uh-huh. Green reached for a notepad.
Incident had a specific meaning to the FAA, referring to the lower category of flight problems that carriers were required to report. Accidents involved deaths or structural damage to the aircraft and were always serious, but with incidents you never knew.
Go ahead.
It's Trans-Pacific Flight 545, incoming from Hong Kong to Denver. Pilots requested emergency landing at LAX. Says they encountered turbulence during flight.
Is the plane airworthy?
They say it is, Levine said. They've got injuries, and they've requested 40 ambulances.
40?
They've also got two stiffs.
Great.
Green got up from his desk.
When's it due in?
18 minutes.
18 minutes? Jeez, why am I getting this so late?
Hey, the captain just told us. We're telling you. I've notified EMS and alerted the fire crews.
Fire crews? I thought you said the plane's okay.
Who knows? The woman said. The pilot's not making much sense. Sounds like he might be in shock. We hand off to the tower in 7 minutes.
Okay, Green said. I'm on my way.
He grabbed his badge and his cell phone and went out the door. As he passed Karen, the receptionist, he said, Have we got anybody at the international terminal?
Kevin's there.
Beep him, Green said. Tell him to get on TPA 545, inbound Hong Kong, landing in 15. Tell him to stay at the gate and don't let the flight crew leave.
Got it, she said, reaching for the phone.
Green roared down Sepulveda Boulevard toward the airport. Just before the highway ran beneath the runway, he looked up and saw the big Trans-Pacific Airlines wide body, identifiable by its bright yellow tail insignia, taxiing toward the gate. Trans-Pacific was a Hong Kong-based charter carrier. Most of the problems the FAA had with foreign airlines occurred with charters. Many were low-budget operators that didn't match the rigorous safety standards of the scheduled carriers, but Trans-Pacific had an excellent reputation. At least the bird was on the ground, Green thought, and he couldn't see any structural damage to the widebody. The plane was an N-22, built by Norton Aircraft in Burbank. The plane had been in revenue service 5 years with an enviable dispatch and safety record. Green stepped on the gas and rushed into the tunnel, passing beneath the giant aircraft. He sprinted through the international building. Through the windows, he saw the Trans-Pacific jet pulled up to the gate, and the ambulances lined up on the concrete below. The first of them was already driving out, its siren whining. Green came to the gate, flashed his badge, and ran down the ramp. Passengers were disembarking, pale and frightened. Many limped, their clothes torn and bloody. On each side of the ramp, paramedics clustered around the injured. As he neared the plane, the nauseating odor of vomit grew stronger. A frightened Trans-Pac stewardess pushed him back at the door, chattering at him rapidly in Chinese. He showed her his badge and said, "FAA, official business, FAA!" The stewardess stepped back, and Green slid past a mother clutching an infant and stepped into the plane. He looked at the interior and stopped. "Oh, my God," he said softly. "What happened to this plane?" Glendale, California, 6 a.m. "Mom, who do you like better, Mickey Mouse or Minnie Mouse?" Standing in the kitchen of her bungalow, still wearing her jogging shorts from her 5-mile morning run, Casey Singleton finished making a tuna sandwich and put it in her daughter's lunchbox. Singleton was 36 years old, a vice president at Norton Aircraft in Burbank. Her daughter sat at the breakfast table eating cereal.
"Well," Allison said, "who do you like better, Mickey Mouse or Minnie Mouse?"
She was 7, and she ranked everything.
"I like them both," Casey said. "I know, Mom," Allison said, exasperated. "But who do you like better?"
"Minnie."
"Me too,"
she said, pushing the carton away. Casey put a banana and a thermos of juice in the lunchbox, closed the lid. "Finish eating, Allison. We have to get ready."
"What's quart?"
"Quart? It's a measure of liquid."
"No, Mom. Quart," she said.
Casey looked over and saw that her daughter had picked up her new laminated plan to ID badge, which had Casey's picture, and beneath that, C. Singleton, and then in large blue letters, Q-A-I-R-T.
"What's quart?"
"It's my new job at the plant. I'm the quality assurance rep on the incident review team."
"Are you still making airplanes?"
Ever since the divorce, Allison had been extremely attentive to change. Even a minor alteration in Casey's hairstyle prompted repeated discussions, the subject brought up again and again over many days. It wasn't surprising she had noticed the new badge.
"Yes, Allie," she said. "I'm still making airplanes. Everything's the same. I just got a promotion."
"Are you still a bum?" she said. Allison had been delighted the year before to learn that Casey was a business unit manager, a BUM.
"Mom's a bum," she'd tell her friends, parents, to great effect.
"No, Allie, now get your shoes on. Your dad'll be picking you up any minute."
"No, he won't," Allison said. "Dad's always late. What's your promotion?"
Casey bent over and began pulling on her daughter's sneakers. "Well," she said, "I still work at QA, but I don't check the planes in the factory anymore. I check them after they leave the plant."
"To make sure they fly?"
"Yes, honey, we check them and fix any problem."
"They better fly," Allison said, "or else they'll crash."
She began to laugh.
They'll all fall out of the sky and hit everybody in their houses right while they're eating their cereal. That wouldn't be too good, would it, Mom?
Casey laughed with her. No, that wouldn't be good at all. The people at the plant would be very upset. She finished tying the laces, swung her daughter's feet away.
Now, where's your sweatshirt?
I don't need it, Allison.
Mom, it's not even cold.
It may be cold later in the week. Get your sweatshirt, please. She heard a horn honk on the street outside, saw Jim's black Lexus in front of the house. Jim was behind the wheel smoking a cigarette. He was wearing a jacket and tie. Perhaps he had a job interview, she thought. Allison stomped around her room, banging drawers. She came back looking unhappy, the sweatshirt hanging from the corner of her backpack.
How come you're always so tense when Dad picks me up?
Casey opened the door, and they walked to the car in the hazy morning sunshine. Allison cried, "Hi, Daddy," and broke into a run. Jim waved back with a boozy grin. Casey walked over to Jim's window. No smoking with Allison in the car, right? Jim stared at her sullenly.
Good morning to you, too.
His voice was raspy. He looked hungover, his face puffy and sallow. We had an agreement about smoking around our daughter, Jim.
Do you see me smoking?
I'm just saying.
And you said it before, Catherine, he said. I've heard it a million times, for Christ's sake.
Casey sighed. She was determined not to fight in front of Allison. The therapist had said that was the reason Allison had begun stuttering. The stuttering was better now, and Casey always made an effort not to argue with Jim, even though he didn't reciprocate. On the contrary, he seemed to take special pleasure in making every contact as difficult as possible.
Okay, Casey said, forcing a smile. See you Sunday.
Their arrangement was that Allison stayed with her father 1 week a month, leaving Monday and returning the following Sunday.
Sunday, Jim nodded curtly. Same as always.
Sunday at 6.
Oh, Christ.
I'm just checking, Jim.
No, you're not. You're controlling the way you always do.
Jim, she said, please, let's not.
Fine with me, he snapped.
She bent over.
Bye, Allie.
Allison said, bye, Mom. But her eyes were already distant, her voice cool. She had transferred her allegiance to her father even before her seatbelt was fastened. Then Jim stepped on the gas, and the Lexus drove away, leaving her standing there on the sidewalk. The car rounded the corner and was gone. Down at the end of the street, she saw the hunched figure of her neighbor Amos, taking his snarling dog for a morning walk. Like Casey, Amos worked at the plant. She waved to him, and he waved back. Casey was turning to go back inside to dress for work when her eye caught a blue sedan parked across the street. There were two men inside. One was reading a newspaper, the other stared out the window. She paused. Her neighbor, Mrs. Alvarez, had been robbed recently. Who were these men? They weren't gangbangers. They were in their 20s with a clean-cut, vaguely military appearance. Casey was thinking about taking down the license plate when her beeper went off with an electronic squeal. She unclipped it from her shorts and read, Star, 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 J-M-I-R-T, 0700, W-R, B-T-O-Y-A. She sighed. Three stars signaled an urgent message. John Martyr, who ran the factory, was calling an IRT meeting for 7 a.m. in the war room. That was a full hour before the regular morning call. Something was up. The final notation confirmed it in plant slang. B-T-O-Y-A. Be there, or it's your ass. Burbank Airport, 6:32 a.m. Rush hour traffic crept forward in the pale morning light. Casey twisted her rearview mirror and leaned over to check her makeup. With her short, dark hair, she was appealing in a tomboyish sort of way, long-limbed and athletic. She played first base on the plant softball team. Men were comfortable around her. They treated her like a kid sister, which served her well at the plant. In fact, Casey had had few problems there. She had grown up in the suburbs of Detroit, the only daughter of an editor at the Detroit News. Her two older brothers were both engineers at Ford. Her mother died when she was an infant, so she had been raised in a household of men.
She had never been what her father used to call a girly girl. After she graduated from Southern Illinois in journalism, Casey had followed her brothers to Ford. But she found writing press releases uninteresting, so she took advantage of the company's continuing education program to get an MBA from Wayne State. Along the way, she married Jim, a Ford engineer, and had a child. But Allison's arrival had ended the marriage. Confronted by diapers and feeding schedules, Jim started drinking, staying out late. Eventually, they separated. When Jim announced he was moving to the West Coast to work for Toyota, she decided to move out, too. Casey wanted Allison to grow up seeing her father. She was tired of the politics at Ford and the bleak Detroit winters. California offered a fresh start. She imagined herself driving a convertible, living in a sunny house near the beach, with palm trees outside her window. She imagined her daughter growing up tanned and healthy. Instead, she lived in Glendale, an hour and a half inland from the beach. Casey had indeed bought a convertible, but she never put the top down. And although the section of Glendale where they lived was charming, gang territories began only a few blocks away. Sometimes at night, while her daughter slept, she heard the faint pop of gunfire. Casey worried about Allison's safety. She worried about her education in a school system where 50 languages were spoken. And she worried about the future because the California economy was still depressed, jobs scarce. Jim had been out of work for 2 years now since Toyota fired him for drinking, and Casey had survived wave after wave of layoffs at Norton where production had slumped thanks to the global recession. She had never imagined she would work for an aircraft company, but to her surprise she had found that her plain-spoken Midwestern pragmatism was perfectly suited to the culture of engineers that dominated the company. Jim considered her rigid and by the book, but her attention to detail had served her well at Norton, where she had for the last year been a vice president of quality assurance. She liked QA, even though the division had a nearly impossible mission. Norton Aircraft was divided into two great factions, production and engineering, which were perpetually at war. Quality assurance stood uneasily between the two. QA was involved in all aspects of production. The division signed off every step of fabrication and assembly. When a problem emerged, QA was expected to get to the bottom of it. That rarely endeared them to mechanics on the line or the engineers. At the same time, QA was expected to deal with customer support problems. Customers were often unhappy with decisions they themselves had made, blaming Norton if the galleys they had ordered were in the wrong place, or if there were too few toilets on the plane. It took patience and political skill to keep everybody happy and get the problems resolved. Casey, a born peacemaker, was especially good at this. In return for walking a political tightrope, workers in QA had the run of the plant. As a vice president, Casey was involved in every aspect of the company's work. She had a lot of freedom and wide-ranging responsibility. She knew her title was more impressive than the job she held. Norton Aircraft was awash in vice presidents. Her division alone had 4 VEEPs, and competition among them was fierce. But now John Martyr had just promoted her to liaison for the IRT. This was a position of considerable visibility, and had put her in line to head the division. Martyr didn't make such appointments casually. She knew he had a good reason for doing it. She turned her Mustang convertible off the Golden State Freeway onto Empire Avenue, following the chain-link fence that marked the south perimeter of Burbank Airport. She headed toward the commercial complexes, Rockwell, Lockheed, and Norton Aircraft. From a distance, she could see the rows of hangars, each with the winged Norton logo painted above. Her car phone rang.
Casey, it's Norma. You know about the meeting?
Norma was her secretary.
I'm on my way, she said. What's going on?
Nobody knows anything, Norma said, but it must be bad. Martyr's been screaming at the engineering heads and he's pushed up the IRT.
John Martyr was the chief operating officer at Norton. Martyr had been program manager on the N-22, which meant he supervised the manufacture of that aircraft. He was a ruthless and occasionally reckless man, but he got results. Martyr was also married to Charlie Norton's only daughter. In recent years, he'd had a lot to say about sales. That made Marder the second most powerful man in the company after the president. It was Marder who had moved Casey up, and it was...
Still with your assistant, Norma said.
My what?
Your new assistant. What do you want me to do with him? He's waiting in your office. You haven't forgotten.
Oh, right. The truth was, she had forgotten. Some nephew of the Norton family was working his way through the divisions. Marder had assigned the kid to Casey, which meant she'd have to babysit him for the next 6 weeks.
What's he like, Norma?
Well, he's not drooling, Norma. He's better than the last one. That wasn't saying much. The last one had fallen off a wing in Major Join and had nearly electrocuted himself in Radio Rack.
How much better?
I'm looking at his resume, Norma said. Yale Law School and a year at GM, but he's been in marketing for the last 3 months and he doesn't know anything about production. You're gonna have to start him from the beginning.
Right, Casey said, sighing. Marder would expect her to bring him to the meeting.
Have the kid meet me in front of administration in 10 minutes, and make sure he doesn't get lost, okay?
You want me to walk him down?
Yeah, you better.
Casey hung up and glanced at her watch. Traffic was moving slowly. Still 10 minutes to the plant. She drummed her fingers on the dashboard impatiently. What could the meeting be about? There might have been an accident or a crash. She turned on the radio to see if it was on the news. She got a talk station, a caller saying,
Not fair to make the kids wear uniforms to school. It's elitist and discriminatory.
Casey pushed a button, changing the station.
Trying to force their personal morality on the rest of us. I don't believe a fetus is a human being.
She pushed another button.
These media attacks are all coming from people who don't like free speech.
Where, she thought, is the news? Had an airplane crashed or not? She had a sudden image of her father reading a big stack of newspapers from all over the country every Sunday after church, muttering to himself,
That's not the story. That's not the story.
As he dropped the pages in an untidy heap around his living room chair. Of course, her father had been a print journalist back in the 1960s. It was a different world now. Now everything was on television. Television, and the mindless chatter on the radio. Up ahead, she saw the main gate of the Norton plant. She clicked the radio off. Norton Aircraft was one of the great names of American aviation. The company had been started by aviation pioneer Charlie Norton in 1935. During World War II, it made the legendary B-22 bomber, the P-27 Skycat fighter, and the C-12 transport for the Air Force. In recent years, Norton had weathered the hard times that had driven Lockheed out of the commercial transport business. Now it was one of just four companies that still built large aircraft for the global market. The others were Boeing in Seattle, McDonnell Douglas in Long Beach, and the European consortium Airbus in Toulouse. She drove through acres of parking lots to Gate 7, pausing at the barrier while security checked her badge. As always, she felt a lift driving into the plant with its three-shift energy, the yellow tugs hauling bins of parts. It wasn't a factory so much as a small city with its own hospital, newspaper, and police force. 60,000 people had worked here when she first came to the company. The recession had trimmed that to 30,000, but the plant was still huge, covering 16 square miles. Here they built the N-20, the narrow-body twin jet, the N-22, the wide-body, and the KC-22, the Air Force fuel tanker. She could see the principal assembly buildings, each more than a mile in length. She headed for the glass administration building in the center of the plant. Pulling into a parking space, she left the engine running. She saw a young man looking collegiate in a sport coat and tie, khaki slacks, and penny loafers. The kid waved diffidently as she got out of the car. Building 64, 6:45 a.m.
Bob Richman, he said. I'm your new assistant.
His handshake was polite, reserved. She couldn't remember which side of the Norton family he was from, but she recognized the type.
Plenty of money, divorced parents, an indifferent record at good schools, and an unshakable sense of entitlement.
"Casey Singleton," she said. "Get in, we're late."
"Late," Richmond said as he climbed into the car. "It's not even 7.
"First shift starts at 6, Casey said. "Most of us in QA work the factory schedule. Don't they do that at GM?
"I wouldn't know," he said. "I wasn't legal."
"Spend any time on the floor?"
"As little as possible."
Casey sighed. It was going to be a long 6 weeks with this guy, she thought. "You've been over in marketing so far?"
"Yeah, a few months," he shrugged. "But selling isn't really my thing."
She drove south toward Building 64, the huge structure where the wide body was built. Casey said, "By the way, what do you drive?"
"A BMW," Richmond said.
"You might want to trade it in," she said, "for an American car."
"Why, it's made here."
"It's assembled here," she said. "It's not made here. The value added's overseas. The mechanics in the plant know the difference. They're all UAW. They don't like to see a Beamer in the parking lot."
Richmond stared out the window. "What are you saying? Something might happen to it?"
"Guaranteed," she said. "These guys don't screw around."
"I'll think about it,"
Richmond said. He suppressed a yawn.
"Jesus, it's early. What are we rushing to?"
"The IRT. It's been pushed up to 7, she said.
"IRT?
"The incident review team. Every time something happens to one of our planes, the IRT meets to figure out what happened and what we should do about it."
"How often do you meet?"
"Roughly every 2 months."
"That often?" the kid said.
"You're going to have to start him from the beginning."
"Actually," Casey said, 2 months is pretty infrequent. We have 3,000 aircraft in revenue service around the world. With that many birds in the air, things happen. And we're serious about customer support, so every morning we hold a conference call with the service reps around the world. They report everything that caused a dispatch delay the day before. Most of it's minor stuff, a lav door jammed, a cockpit light failed, but we track it in QA, do a trend analysis, and pass that on to product support."
"Uh-huh." He sounded bored.
"Then," Casey said, "once in a while we hit a problem that warrants an IRT. It has to be serious, something that affects flight safety. Apparently we've got one today. If Martyr's pushed the meeting up to 7, you can bet it's not a bird strike."
"Martyr?"
"John Martyr was the program manager for the wide body before he became chief operating officer, so it's probably an incident involving the N-22. She pulled over and parked in the shadow of Building 64. The gray hangar loomed above them, 8 stories high and nearly a mile long. The asphalt in front of the building was strewn with disposable earplugs, which the mechanics wore so they wouldn't go deaf from the rivet guns. They walked through the side doors and entered an interior corridor that ran around the perimeter of the building. The corridor was dotted with food dispensers in clusters a quarter of a mile apart. Richmond said, "We got time for a cup of coffee?" She shook her head.
"Coffee's not allowed on the floor."
"No coffee?" he groaned.
"Why not? It's made overseas."
"Coffee's corrosive. Aluminum doesn't like it."
Casey led Richmond through another door onto the production floor.
"Jesus," Richmond said.
The huge, partially assembled wide-body jets gleamed under halogen lights. 15 aircraft in various stages of construction were arranged in 2 long rows under the vaulted roof. Directly ahead of them, she saw mechanics installing cargo doors in the fuselage sections. The barrels of the fuselage were surrounded by scaffolding. Beyond the fuselage stood a forest of assembly jigs, immense tools, painted bright blue. Richmond walked under one of the jigs and looked up, open-mouthed. It was as wide as a house and 6 stories tall.
"Amazing," he said. He pointed upward at a broad, flat surface. "Is that the wing?"
"The vertical stabilizer," Casey said.
"The what?"
"It's the tail, Bob."
"That's the tail?"
Richmond said. Casey nodded.
"The wing is over there,"
she said, pointing across the floor. "It's 200 feet long, almost as long as a football field." A klaxon sounded. One of the overhead cranes began to move.
Richmond turned to look. This is your first time on the floor?
Yeah.
Richmond was turning around, looking in all directions.
Awesome, he said.
They're big, Casey said.
Why are they all lime green?
We coat the structural elements with epoxy to prevent corrosion, and the aluminum skins are covered so they don't get dinged during assembly. The skins are highly polished and very expensive, so we leave that coating on until paint shed.
Sure doesn't look like GM, Richmond said, still turning and looking.
That's right, Casey said. Compared to these aircraft, cars are a joke.
Richmond turned to her, surprised. A joke?
Think about it, she said. A Pontiac has 5,000 parts, and you can build one in 2 shifts, 16 hours. That's nothing. But these things, she gestured to the aircraft looming high above them, are a completely different animal.
The wide body has 1 million parts and a span time of 75 days. No other manufactured product in the world has the complexity of a commercial aircraft. Nothing even comes close. And nothing is built to be as durable. You take a Pontiac and run it all day every day and see what happens. It'll fall apart in a few months. But we design our jets to fly for 20 years of trouble-free service, and we build them to twice the service life.
40 years? Richmond said, incredulous. You build them to last 40 years?
Casey nodded. We've still got lots of N5s in service around the world, and we stopped building them in 1946. We've got planes that have accumulated 4 times their design life, the equivalent of 80 years of service. Norton planes will do that. Douglas planes will do that, but no one else's birds will do that. You understand what I'm saying?
Wow, Richmond said, swallowing.
We call this the bird farm, Casey said. The planes are so big it's hard to get a sense of the scale. She pointed to one aircraft to their right, where small clusters of people worked at various positions, with portable lights shining up on the metal.
Doesn't look like many people, right?
No, not many.
There's probably 200 mechanics working on that plane, enough to run an entire automobile line. But this is just one position on our line, and we have 15 positions in all. There's 5,000 people in this building right now.
The kid was shaking his head, amazed.
It looks sort of empty.
Unfortunately, Casey said, it is sort of empty. The wide-body line's running at 60% capacity, and 3 of those birds are whitetails.
Whitetails?
Planes we're building without customers. We build at a minimum rate to keep the line open, and we haven't got all the orders we want. The Pacific Rim's the growth sector, but with Japan in recession, that market's not placing orders, and everybody else is flying their planes longer, so business is very competitive.
This way.
She started up a flight of metal stairs, walking quickly. Richmond followed her footsteps clanging. They came to a landing, went up another flight.
I'm telling you this, she said, so you'll understand the meeting we're going to. We build the hell out of these planes. People here are proud of what they do, and they don't like it when something goes wrong.
They arrived at a catwalk high above the assembly floor and walked toward a glass-walled room that seemed to be suspended from the roof. They came to the door. Casey opened it.
And this, she said, is the war room.
War room, 7:01 a.m. She saw it freshly through his eyes. A large conference room with gray indoor-outdoor carpeting, a round formica table, tubular metal chairs. The walls were